Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today we had the privilege to be joined by Mark Bear. How are you, Mark?
Yeah, doing well, thank you.
Good. It's amazing to have you here, and looking forward to listening to your story, your experiences, because we know the powerful impact this is going to have on so many men. So let's jump straight into it. Let's start right back at the beginning. What was pre-fertility or infertility life like, and like talk us through the story to your diagnosis.
So I guess the first thing is, but I don't really remember what life was like prior to the last kind of four and a half years of infertility. But I was married. I was naive about parenthood. I assumed that you decide to start a family and it just happens. There was no part of me that had any inkling whatsoever that there could possibly be a problem with starting a family. And my wife and I used to argue about when to start trying. She wanted to start trying, and I would say, oh, but when we start trying, we need to be prepared for if it happens immediately type of thing. So that was the source of many an argument, which I kind of regret now. But yeah.
I think that's a common thought for many people. Like I remember thinking, oh, when we want to have children, it will just happen. It's not meant to happen right now. We didn't really not try. We just said, oh, well, it will happen when it's the time's right. And obviously it didn't.
And also very common that like the guy, anyone we speak to who has been through this can like that life before seems like a distant memory because of, especially for those journeys. Oh, well, straight in there, 2 minutes in, we've used the J word, but,
I was avoiding that.
Yeah, I know. It's impossible. I've given up now. But yeah, it's because it changes you. It changes you as a person, as a couple, and it's all consuming, isn't it? So yeah, those times before then, literally just before we jumped on tonight, my wife was she had just put some old boots on, Vinted, and she mentioned how much I had paid for them for her as a present, and it was like quite eye watering, and I was like, oh yeah. Those were different times when suddenly then every aspect of finances has to be weighed up during like a fertility journey because you think, oh, that could be going on this or that. And yeah, different times, eh?
Yeah, definitely different times. So what was like the first inkling that you kind of, you thought there might be an issue then? Because obviously you've said you didn't think there would be. But kind of how did that play out in terms of finding out?
So we were trying for about a year with no success. We went for some routine tests that included a sperm analysis. It was the doctor's lab in central London. I went there and I did the test, and then I got a phone call a few days later saying, you've done the test wrong. And I was like, okay, so it's Finn, but I'm pretty sure I know how to do this, but I've done it wrong. Okay, yes, must be me, I've done it wrong. So I went back, and I think every room there has the same red chair, but that's another story. It's a very strange place. So I did the test again, and a few days later I got a call and they said, you've done the test wrong. I was like, I'm pretty sure I know how to do this, but okay. The thing that kind of strikes me is that given that most men who end up with a diagnosis of azoospermia or such, the route is often via fertility testing. The route is often via sperm analysis or something like that. it strikes me that at no point was there a, this might be a red flag. Maybe he's not doing it wrong. Maybe we shouldn't kind of put this pressure or kind of like self-doubt on this person. Like maybe it's a big issue. So there's something around that in terms of kind of information, knowledge, I guess education, training, that sort of thing. But yeah, so following that, we went to see a urologist. We had an appointment with Jonathan Ramsey, and then I managed to get an appointment with Pippa Sandster about a week before Jonathan Ramsey. So I cancelled Jonathan Ramsey and went to Pippa because I basically just wanted to be seen quicker. Coincidentally, it turns out that Pippa Sandster co-founded a Klinefelter's clinic at UCLH. So that was complete potluck. But she sent me for some tests, which included a genetic blood test to test my karyotype amongst some other tests. And that test came back, don't want to say positive for Klinefelter, it came back saying that I have 47XXY, which means that I have, rather than 46 chromosomes of XY for general men, my chromosomes are XXY, so I have an extra X chromosome, so I have 47. And that diagnosis of Klinefelter's came as a complete shock, because as I said before, I didn't have any inkling that there could be anything wrong with the process, let alone a problem with me. So I had the Klinefelter's diagnosis. Klinefelter's is kind of reasonably common in that 1 in 600 men have Klinefelter's, but it's very, very badly understood. There's a website by the Klinefelter's Syndrome Association, which is a free resource, and I recommend that anyone who's listening to this and has Klinefelter's or wants to know more about it checks out their website, which I believe these guys will put in the show notes. They have a page on there which is dedicated to common symptoms, how it can affect you, kind of health concerns amongst other things. And there's another website by Living with XXY, which has a similar page dedicated to the positive traits of Klinefelter's, which is quite interesting. So for me, the symptoms that I experience are infertility, low testosterone, poor upper body strength. At university, I got really into going to the gym, but I never put on any size. And that kind of now makes more sense. Kind of low body hair, another word I always struggle with. Gynecomastia, which is kind of breast tissue. Unexplained tiredness, poor short-term memory, kind of difficult to remember things that may have just been said, and etc. And it's worth noting that these are things that general people can experience too. Having these things doesn't mean you have Klinefelter's. Having the karyotype means you have Klinefelter's, but these are just examples. General low self-esteem and kind of things like that. And I was diagnosed at school with dyslexia and dyspraxia, which I now realize was because of the Klinefelter's. So in some ways the diagnosis was really like kind of pulling the carpet from beneath my feet. But at the same time, further down the line and looking back, it explains a lot about my childhood and experiences growing up and that sort of thing. And it's kind of like I always felt a bit different, and having a piece of paper that says, oh, you are different, both kind of screwed with my head and helped at the same time. So if anyone's listening to this and is experiencing something similar to that, that's a normal response. Just to touch on some of the positives. I am sometimes surprised when people say these aren't normal things for everyone else, but I have a extremely good sense of direction. I can picture a map and tell you. So if I go on holiday with my wife and we walk from a hotel for the first time to where we're going, I have a general sense of which direction the hotel is in without looking at a map or Google Maps or etc. Apparently that's a Klinefelter spin. Empathy and kind of the, I guess, emotional intelligence side of things. So I've developed a really keen interest in mental health, and I'm a mental health first aider, and I try to support people where I can through that too. And I now realize that through the Klinefelters, that's helped me with developing the emotional intelligence and empathy and that sort of thing. Those are kind of the symptoms that I would say I relate to the most. But just to jump back a second, so I mentioned the KSA. There's two Klinefelter's clinics in London. There's one at UCLH, which Pippa Sandster co-founded. There's another one at Guy's and St. Thomas at London Bridge. I have been at the UCLH one, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. I would really encourage anyone where Klinefelter has been mentioned to have a look online for one of his clinics and see if there's a route that they can take to be referred to them. There's also support networks on Facebook. There's the WhatsApp group and Instagram that you guys run. There's also there's a guy called Raj Baxi, who we'll put him a name in the show notes, who runs a dedicated private Men with Klinefelter's group, which has been a great source of support. And I think the main thing I'd say in this is that anyone listening to this who has Klinefelter's is not alone, basically. But yeah, so jumping back to my story, so or my journey. So I got this Klinefelter's diagnosis, and we decided that I was going to have a micro T surgery to see if they could extract sperm for use with IVF. My testosterone was tested at this point. It was around 5 or 6. I always forget the units, but 5 or 6. I was prescribed Clomid, which is a oral tablet, which is supposed to increase your testosterone through those means. I did not agree with Clomid, and about 2 or 3 months later, after essentially being sapped of all energy, and throughout my entire infertility journey, I've been working and such. But on Clomid, my testosterone dropped to 0.8, which is pretty low. And so then Pippa prescribed me HCG injections. I should probably mention, at this point, I had an absolute catastrophic fear of needles and injections. So I now don't, but that's kind of been a learning experience, and I am very grateful to my wife for helping me with all 108 or so injections up to micro T's. One part that I have accidentally skipped over is so I got referred to Homerton Hospital for IVF by my GP in Enfield. That hit a brick wall because we were told that we were assigned or prescribed, or whatever you call it. We were referred for three cycles of IVF. However, they didn't have the facilities to deal with male factor infertility, and they wouldn't refer me to a different hospital in a different area unless I came under kind of special circumstances. And having male factor infertility with a genetic condition doesn't count as a special circumstance. So so that was a bit of a kick in the teeth at the time. So given that I was working up to for micro-T surgery, and given that I believe we were at a point of the pandemic at this point, my wife and I decided, and we were also having building work done on the house, which we decided to do prior to IVF because we probably wouldn't have made that decision after because of the cost of IVF. But so we decided to rent a place closer to UCLH and therefore be in the Camden postcode and therefore be able to sign up to a Camden GP, which we did. And they said, great, you can have 3 rounds of IVF. So that was great.
Wow.
It's worth noting that within this process, they lost my wife's test results 3 times. And I guess one thing that I would say in this to anyone listening is, if something doesn't feel right in your process or your way, or you haven't heard from your doctor or whatever, chase them. Like, take the lead and chase them, because a lot of the time it will be that actually your first thought or your first feeling is correct, and the people who should be looking after you do need that chase. So that's just one thing I would say.
Yeah, we took a similar approach of we called it, we wanted to be the squeaky wheels that were going to get oiled. We were a pain in their ass, essentially, in every aspect, whether it's GPs, like the bureaucratic and administrative side of the NHS that does the funding applications, and then moving forward onto the fertility clinic, we were making sure that they always knew who we were, and we were never letting them have a let up. So yeah, that is, it's great advice.
Yeah, that was I became very, very familiar with their hold music, but also exactly where I could park in Camden for free to go into their GP surgery and demand to know an update. So, So I did the HCG injections. My testosterone got raised to about 12 to 18 ish. I, at this point, was doing everything I possibly could to be prepared for micro-Ts in terms of exercise and eating and supplements and et cetera, et cetera. I then had the micro-Ts. And technically, my micro-Ts was successful. So they found sperm, but it wasn't viable for IVF. And that was I did a post on my Instagram, which we can add a link to in the show notes. But the post was called "Worse Than Zero," because I kind of feel it would have been better to be told there is no sperm. To be told, "Oh, we found something, but we can't use it," was difficult. We then, after the surgery, Pippa told us about a study that had, like, really, really recently, within days of me actually having the surgery, been done, where they looked at 88 micro-T's surgery recipients, and they followed the successful results through to pregnancy and those pregnancies through to birth. And out of the study of 88 micro-T's patients, there were only 5 live births, which is about 5% or so. And I remember having a conversation with my wife about this, because for me, being able to squash the what if was really important. But I think that if we had known about this study prior, I think my wife would have been much more hesitant to be on board with this. And I think that it's really important for couples, men, couples, etc., to be able to make informed decisions on all of the information. Like, 80% chance means it'll probably work, but it might not. 50% means we don't know. 20% means We're not expecting this to work, but it might. Like, the percentages are complete bullshit. And every situation is different. Everyone has the hope that it will work. But I do think it's really important to share the full story with people rather than promising a miracle surgery that might work, if that makes sense.
We asked that question specifically of a urologist on our last series about the live birth rate percentages post micro-TZ. And yeah, he was quite honest. And I think from memory, it was around 15 to 17% overall.
Yeah.
Because it's important to know. And like you said, people need to make informed decisions. And when, for example, prior to my micro-TZ, they said, oh, it's about a 50% chance we'll find sperm. But actually, I needed to, what would have been more handy is what that sperm might be capable of. Because
yeah,
if it's going to be very poor quality, is the juice worth the squeeze, essentially, with what is a big operation?
That's a fantastic analogy. So we had micro-TZ. I got very acquainted with the penguin cowboy waddle of how to get from A to B or upstairs or etc. We then had a I'm skipping over a little bit, but we then had a consultation with Pippa, where we found out that we had lost our funding for Camden IVF. Because Camden, it may have changed by now, but because of the joys of the postcode lottery, at the time, Camden would have covered us for donor sperm if we were a same-sex couple, but they wouldn't cover heterosexual couples with donor sperm. So they basically said, you tried everything you could, but you can't use your own biology, and therefore we won't give you funding.
Wow.
Obviously not in those words, but that's the facetious way of looking at it.
That's quite incredible. You've had that upheaval. You've moved house tactically from Borough of Enfield to Borough of Camden because you weren't funded in the first place, like where you lived. So you moved knowing that it would facilitate that funding, and then that funding was swept from underneath you. And yeah, I mean, how did you feel after that?
I would have said it was a kick in the balls, but at that point in time, that would have been excruciatingly painful. And yeah, probably a kick in the balls.
Yeah, I bet. So what did you do after that?
So after that, I had the period of recovering from a micro-TZ and kind of getting back on my feet. And we had a dog, so getting back on dog walks and et cetera. We got the dog when we were trying to start a family and it wasn't working. And I'd say dog walks, like having a small creature that you need to look after and distracts you from whatever's going on, and going on dog walks together and talking about how we were feeling and how we kind of what was going on and et cetera, I think was a massive savior for my relationship through all of this. I think there's a study on kind of how talking about mental health, walking next to someone outside and talking is significantly more powerful and brings more out than sitting in a coffee shop face to face.
Yeah.
So I think we really felt that.
Oh yeah, I think I've talked about it on the pod before, but my wife and I kind of stumbled across that, so to speak, through lockdown. Like up until then, 3 years of going through it, and I barely uttered a word. And like you said, when you're face to face, and it feels like that kind of an interview or therapy, which again for men is heavily stigmatized. But actually, then when we were going out for walks during the lockdown, first lockdown, for our allotted hour, I've started opening up, and that's when everything started changing, because it is that shoulder to shoulder thing. You're outside, you're in nature, you're getting the health benefits from being hopefully in sunshine, but you're at the very least, you know, you're still outside and the sunlight is there. It's the connection of being with someone, with, you know, especially in this case, your closest one who's living through this with you. And yeah, I couldn't advocate for that more.
Yeah, I completely agree. So while I was recovering, we decided that we were going to proceed with a donor. And we looked through the various, essentially, yellow pages of donors. It's a very weird process. But the way that we approached it in the end was, I didn't want to see baby photos, because I didn't want to associate the baby that we might one day end up with what's the baby photo of this person who I now see as kind of, I have so much gratitude towards the donor. But at that particular point in time, I just wanted to kind of work with kind of text and words and etc. But that's just, I guess what I'm saying there is, but like everyone will approach it differently, and there's no wrong or right way. But we found a donor bank which had an ethos that we really liked. We found a donor which we agreed on, and then we decided to proceed with that, and we found an IVF clinic. We found an IVF clinic which had a ethos that we liked as well. The kind of ethos of the people who we worked with was really important to us, and we decided to proceed with donor sperm essentially. And at this point, I had a similar naivety to when I believed that you decide to start trying and you have, and the baby just happens. I kind of assume that if you have a healthy uterus and you put it with healthy donor sperm and you put it with IVF, which costs about the same as getting your house extended, so it kind of, you're paying a lot, so therefore it must be good, right? And you put all those things together and it should just work, right? And I think the things that I kind of learned there are that trying doesn't equal a baby, and microtease doesn't equal sperm, and sperm doesn't equal usable sperm, and a donor and a healthy uterus doesn't equal successful IVF, and IVF doesn't equal a baby. And after all of that, when one does become pregnant, it's quite normal to be extremely anxious about that pregnancy, and also to have to-ing and throwing and roundabouts and seesaws. I don't know why it's all children's kind of playground equipment, kind of thoughts and anxieties around using a donor. We decided to do IVF privately. We had a miscarriage. We had multiple failed rounds. We had multiple egg collections. When my wife had the miscarriage, she had a procedure that is now banned in some states of the US under the abortion laws. And if she hadn't had the procedure, then she could well have developed complications or died, which is probably a topic for a completely separate podcast in itself, but that is just really harrowing for me. And we, in the end, we did testing for my wife, and we followed some specialized protocols, and we had a successful round. So she fell pregnant, and it was joyous and incredibly anxiety provoking at the same time.
Oh, yes.
And I don't think it's explainable what that is like unless you've been through previous stuff. Like, I remember trying to explain to some of my friends, they were like, "But you're pregnant now," and I'd be like, "Yes, but the last 4 years, every time we get our hopes up, it all goes to shit." So I had significant anxieties around using a donor. which I can go into or we can have a conversation about, but just to try and finish my very long-winded story about our journey into this, I had significant anxieties, which when our son was born, literally disappeared. And it's when people said that to me while my wife was pregnant, I didn't believe them. And I don't expect anyone to believe me or even you guys when we say it. But him existing, being born, kind of smiling, etc., meant that a lot of those anxieties just didn't exist anymore. And the other day, someone said to my wife that my son has my smile, and that meant the absolute world to me. Mm. I've got quite used to kind of fielding, kind of like, oh, he has blue eyes. Who in your family has blue eyes? Oh, he has this color hair. Who in your family has that color hair? And I'm trying to field those questions because it's kind of, it's we've decided to be open, but it's also, people say stupid things, and they don't say stupid things to then be owed the information. The Donor Conception Network has been fantastic resource, and I went to a men only meeting in a pub in South London, I think it was, and just being able to sit around the table and talk to other people with donor conceived kids was really meaningful and helped me with some of the ways I was thinking, because I had been thinking, oh, I need to preempt every person in my life to prepare them for if my son says something to them about being donor conceived, and going to that meeting kind of made me realize, well, no, we don't need to do that. So
yeah. You mentioned some of the anxieties you had about using donor sperm. Like, can you talk us through what it was that got you, like where you were, and how you got to the point of then being comfortable enough to proceed with that?
I think when we were picking a donor, I wouldn't necessarily have said that I was fully over the surgery or the emotional side of a surgery or such, but I knew that it was the right course of action, the next course of action, kind of the right thing for us, etc. I went into therapy, which has helped massively. And I think whether it's therapy or coaching, having the opportunity to talk about what's going on for one's self, which is ever changing and valid because it's been felt, is really important. So I kind of looked at that as what's right for us is to use a donor. I'm going to do the work that is necessary for any of the stuff going on for me around this, so that it isn't an issue when this baby at some point is born.
Yeah. And other than therapy, was there anything else that you did to get you there? What did that work consist of?
So I had a lot of anxieties around kind of, but what if a baby at some point says, or child at this point sometimes says, you're not my real dad, or wants to get to know their kind of donor, or like, it's interesting because at the time it was all I could think about, but now I can't actually remember all of the anxieties, which kind of shows that it does morph and it does change, and those things that we think are all consuming or are all consuming at the time can change and can get better with time.
Well, anxiety lives in the future. And often then when you, when you're in that future, it, it's not like what we envisioned it. It's, we build up these maybe like safeguarding elements of like, it's don't go all in or emotionally type thing of like, if I go all in, then I can be hurt. And then maybe we hold back a little bit, but actually when you are there, and like you've mentioned that when your son was born, that they disappeared. So can you talk about how that is now? Like, what advice would you give to anyone who is perhaps in that point of worry and anxiety about using donor sperm?
So I think the advice I'd give is probably around research, education and support. So researching the things that you don't know, it's a lot. It's like there's a whole host of stuff that I now know or need to know, which a parent who hasn't gone via this route probably hasn't even thought about yet. So researching, educating oneself, also educating people around them. And I guess the key piece of advice around that for me is probably not doing more than you can at a given point in time. So there were points where I would kind of stop looking after myself, kind of disengage with kind of the everyday or work or my relationship or whatever, because I had to find out everything that I possibly could about Kleinfelters or using a donor or the perspectives of a donor child of a really niche Instagram account, etc. But I think trying to recognize how you feel about the information as you read it or as you take it in, or taking the moments to reflect and being able to say, actually, this is a bit too much right now, I'm going to take a break from that topic, really helps overall with being able to develop how you feel about the position that you're in.
You've blown me away, really, mate, with your, you've talked very openly about how challenging it has been in terms of the process and in terms of the anxiety, but you always bring it back to a positive note. And I think when you're in the, when you're trenches, as we call it, it's really hard to see that. But actually what you've just explained is by acknowledging where you are and how you feel, and taking small controllable steps, for example, educating yourself about your condition and things like that, allows you to feel in more control, which then will allow you to process things. And you've talked so positively through this whole kind of the podcast, even when we go right back to talking about the support group for Kleinfelter syndrome. You know, you talked about the positives, not just the negatives. And when you're in that hole, finding out all these things about yourself, the diagnosis, it's very hard to see that. So I just want to say it's amazing to hear you talk, mate. It really is. And I hope other guys are listening and going, well, hopefully I can take something from this. Because positivity when things are dark is really hard to find. But it definitely seems to have helped you, buddy. Even if at the time it doesn't feel positive, you know?
Yeah.
It's incredibly difficult.
I really appreciate you saying that. In the period of time between finding out my microtease results, choosing a donor, starting IVF, the various fail points after that, I lost my sense of hope. Before this, I was a fairly strong believer that everything happens for a reason. Infertility is a surefire way to kind of destroy any fundamental belief you have it like that. So I lost my sense of hope. I lost my sense of self. I lost my sense of kind of basically everything. And it was kind of therapy and coaching which has helped me, together with the support groups, together with kind of finding Sean and sitting in a park and talking with other men about their experiences. I try to pitch in on the WhatsApp group where I can because I have some experience. I don't necessarily know that what I say is helpful or not, but if someone's in a really dark place, then someone's saying something, let alone if it's kind of actually good information or not, I think is worthwhile. And which is part of the reason that I agreed to come on the podcast, because I kind of sunk to a really low point, but I think where I am right now is much better than the low point where I sunk to. So I really appreciate what you said.
Well, it's you know, you might not feel, like I said, you might not feel it, but you project it. Positivity is something that is, even when the clouds are over your head, you can still project it, you know, because of the way you talk. And, you know, I've read the messages that you've put on the WhatsApp group and things like that, and it's always from your experience, and people find that helpful. You know, like a lot of the guys out there, you know, 99% of the guys out there facing this, don't know what to do, don't know how to process it. And to have someone like yourself just go, well, this is what my experience of this and this and this, it just gives something, or gives them something to at least kind of relate to in some way. And, you know, it really brought a smile to my face when you talked about when, you know, when your son was born, you know, all those anxieties, all those questions, they just, they rise, don't they? That feeling disappears, because actually, me and Sean have talked about this on the podcast, off the podcast, you know, the role of a father, you know, and it's something that I've definitely learned, is that, you know, that biological link isn't as important as society makes it out to be. You know, it takes it's a completely different role from being what I'd call a biological father to being a dad. You know, to actually bringing up a child, it's a lot more challenging. You know, I always say it's the best job, but the toughest job I've ever had, and it'd be the toughest thing I'll ever do. But it really made me smile, and it was great to hear that you say that, buddy. It really was.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
You remind me a lot of a perspective that I took, and I think as well it's worth pointing out to anyone listening who is, like Kieran said, in the trenches. Often a lot of this isn't overnight. It's a long process, but it got to the point where I started thinking, like, this has happened. This is an event, and nothing's going to change that. How do I now deal with this, and how do I move forward? Do I just constantly attach this negative connotation to it, or do I actually turn it into a positive and leverage it? And it sounds to me very much like you had those moments too.
Yeah. I still have low points. I've realized that with Klinefelter, one of the symptoms of having Klinefelter's is being quite pre-exposed to low mood. And I now really recognize the difference. Well, I try to recognize the difference between low mood and depression. I have had depression as part of this process. I have low mood at points. It's hard. But the I guess the thing that I try to do, and some weeks are better than other weeks, but the thing I try to do is to be intentional. So to take a few minutes in the morning, on the on my commute, or during the day, or when I notice that I've kind of spiraling or been triggered by something, to try and take a few minutes with a piece of paper and a pen to bring myself back to, this is how I want to be. These are my core values. This is how I want to behave. This is how I want to kind of be today, or etc. Because I still have those days where I feel really crap about kind of everything that we've been through, and I have this bundle of joy in front of me, who is sometimes a bundle of joy and sometimes the hardest thing I've ever had to deal with. But a lot of it is being intentional, and the other part is the choosing to show up. Like, I don't have the biological link. I want to be his dad. I want to be his dad. I want to be the best dad that I can be. And to some extent, I want to be in a position where if someone who didn't know was to find out that I wasn't his biological dad, I would want them to say, I never would have realized, I never would have known, I never would have, etc. And for me, what that looks like to me is being intentional about how I am with my son, in my work, in myself, and how I interact with other people.
Yeah, so important. And what you've said is so true, is that being an intentional father is a choice. And it's a really important one to make, because some people perhaps do take that position for granted. I truly don't believe that anyone who's gone through fertility struggles will ever take parenting for granted. Of course, it's not all sunshine and butterflies or whatever, and there are hard times. I remember thinking, oh, when we get there, I'm going to make the most of every moment. I don't, like, even the sleepless nights on that, that it's almost impossible. It's very hard. But I do think that there's always that undercurrent of gratitude and appreciation of there, and of getting there, and of then making those choices. Like, it takes a lot for me to do anything that doesn't involve my kids. I have the kind of thought process that I go through to spend a weekend away or even a day away. It's a big thing for me to do it, because I love it and I strive to get there, and I don't take a moment of that for granted.
No, it's a special thing, isn't it? And I think it's, you know, Mark, you said there that, you know, we want to do everything. So he recognizes you as his dad, and it sounds like, you know, you are his dad. You're doing everything right. And it's an amazing, beautiful thing, man. But it isn't easy. You know, as Sean often describes it as a carnage.
You said it today, didn't we? When you asked if I was free at a certain time, and I was like, can't do then. My household is carnage at that time.
And we often exchange text messages about how, you know, my little gremlin, who's just like off on one, and they go, yeah, mine's doing it too. Don't worry about it. It is tough. It is tough. But, you know, give you those strategies that you've talked about are phenomenal, mate. And I think people could use those in general life, not just in this situation. I think life is so busy, you know, and you add infertility in the mix. Sometimes you just need grounding, and to do that with a pen and pencil, a pen and pad, and just sit there and, you know, write down, who am I? What are my values? What am I grateful for? You know, and you quickly realize that what you're worrying about, you know, don't need to worry about it. It will sort itself out. It will pass. It'll be all right. Yeah. But you have to learn that. You have to learn that.
Yeah. And the with regards to journaling, so when I was in the thick of it, so now I am kind of more intentional about kind of the questions I ask myself, what I write. But at the time, I would just open a page, put the date at the top, and just write whatever came to mind. And that in itself gave me a really good insight into, like, not necessarily at the time, it was just getting it out. But then looking back at it really helped to be able to reflect on, I was in a really crap place there. I'm not in my place right now. That's weird. Type of thing.
Yeah. I speak very highly about that, and it's really important. I used an app called Day One, and I fully recommend it because it gives you anniversaries that come up as well. So it will say on this day, like in whatever year. And so you can, and it will, it's a quick click on it, and you can see, like, I often see where I was in the thick of it. And it's like, wow, how far I've come since then, the things that I was thinking about. Because when you get it out of your head onto paper, or I was doing it on an app, it helps make sense of a lot of stuff, because in your mind, you just can reverberate you can not make sense of it. When you're seeing it looking back at you, often you realize how irrational some thoughts are.
Yeah. But
gratitude, again, I got into that massively. It really helps. It's been, or people almost take the piss out of it a little bit, is try it, because once you start turning your mind to the things that you can be grateful and have to be grateful for in life, it's really powerful. But Mark, I just want to take you back to something you mentioned earlier, and I thought I've got to ask you about this. So you mentioned your initial diagnosis of acouspermia and then your subsequent diagnosis of Klinefelter's. Like, how did they feel the same, or were they wildly different, and how did that come up for you? How did you respond to each of those?
So the initial diagnosis of acouspermia floored me. It felt like a complete carpet ripped from beneath my feet. I guess that was my going from being very naive to this is the real world now moment. And trying to make sense of the world from there, and etc. The diagnosis of Klinefelter's was, on the one hand, it was like another nail in the, don't want to say coffin, but it was like another nail in the side. Kind of, it's not just that you have this thing that you never expected, but here's a double whammy type of thing. But there's also, it also made a lot of sense out of kind of my experiences so far. Kind of from insecurities I had to how I felt tired a lot of the time for no real reason, to kind of the learning difficulties that I've had and now realize was because of the Klinefelter's. I mean, I was fortunate to have been diagnosed with the dyslexia, dyspraxia, kind of when I was at school. I guess I've done quite a lot of work around the Klinefelter's. But as part of the Klinefelter's clinic at UCLH, they have a counselor who specializes in Klinefelter's and testosterone replacement therapy and etc. So I've worked with her to kind of better understand it. At the moment, I try to think about the Klinefelter's to accept the Klinefelter's and allow it to be a part of me, I treat it. I know it sounds a bit corny, but I say it's like it's my superpower. So it's this thing which could so easily be so inherently negative, but it makes me who I am. It makes me different from the norm. The norm is overrated. And it enables me to excel in areas that I otherwise wouldn't have, and seems that not everyone does, and everyone is different, and everyone can find that within themselves. When I got diagnosed with acouspermia, I probably because of interest in mental health and wanted to help others and support others, I wanted to kind of be an advocate for male fat infertility and such. And when I got diagnosed with the Klinefelters, I felt like that was taken away from me, because I was suddenly, with azoospermia, I was in the support groups of lots of people with azoospermia and who I could relate to on all of these different levels. And then when I got diagnosed with the Klinefelters, I was suddenly alone again. So being able to appear on this podcast and being able to, I guess, break one of my own blocks and say, actually, that's bullshit, is actually really helpful, because the truth is that I can at least try to help people with my own experiences, regardless of how I got there.
Yeah, man. I mean, one of the things that me and Sean have talked to between us, thousands of people, thousands of guys now, and one thing that a lot have in common are the emotional stresses and anxieties and worries. So although someone might not have Klinefelter syndrome, it's a fact of emotionally, you understand what people are going through. There's so much, you know, you can give so much more. It's, even though I can completely understand, you know, getting that diagnosis makes you think, where do I fit now? Because it's additional. But it's great to have you on and to, you know, for you to be talking so openly, because guys will be listening to this that don't have the condition, but will go, actually, I feel like that. I worry about that, because we're looking at donor conception, and, you know, the similarities are massive across the board. And it's something that I think I've only come to realize after talking to so many guys, you know. I wanted just to talk very briefly about how your diagnosis affected your relationship with your partner, and like how, because you talked very, very briefly about how it's been a bit difficult at points, but how did that kind of unravel, and how she supported you in the times of need when you've needed it?
So I'm pleased that you asked, because I was aware that we hadn't touched on this and wasn't entirely sure how to bring it back round to it. So thank you for asking. I think that infertility has the power to break a relationship pretty swiftly and pretty easily. There are so many emotions at play. There are kind of what do you want from the other person, whether they can give it to you at the time, how you approach all of that. It's so difficult and volatile and emotional and often irrational on both sides. Like, it's hard. But I think that for us, having a dog and going on the dog walks and kind of, to some extent, this is the time when we are either going to walk in silence together or we're going to talk about what's on our minds. So creating time with no pressure to talk. And also coming back to the intentionality, assuming that's a real word, creating little pockets and moments of joy. So everything is shit right now, but we're going to do this little thing which might make us smile for a minute, and then we'll go back into everything being shit again. And for me, I had, so prior to my son being born, when my wife was pregnant, I had this massive guilt that I carried around with me. Like, I felt that we're doing this because of me, and if you weren't with me, you wouldn't have to do this, and all this pain that you're going through is because of me. And no matter how much my wife told me that that was not how she felt, that did not stop me from feeling it. And I guess what I did with that is I spoke about it in coaching and therapy, but also I spoke to people in support groups and such. But so I try to channel that into the kind of when I'm able to, what can I do? So I feel I feel absurdly guilty about this thing which I have no control over and I wasn't trying to do, but etc. But what I can do is try to do like a little thoughtful thing, like I got my wife a cold pack in the shape of a pineapple for when she did her injections to numb the site before the injection type of thing. Or I kind of try to find those little moments of joy when I had capacity to, when she didn't have any capacity. And so that's, those were kind of little things that I tried to do, recognizing that she had been there for me when I was going through all of my stuff, and trying to be there for her while she was going through her stuff. Like I see men who don't go through infertility who become dads, and in the first couple of months of being a dad don't really know what to do, because like NCT tells you how to kind of get the baby home, they don't actually tell you how to be a dad. Like in that kind of first couple of months, you're kind of a bit useless. Like, so my role in those few months was to try and make sure there was water and snacks and kind of like do the little things rather than kind of doing the macro actually kind of things as such. And I guess what the reason that I mentioned that is, I think I, in that period of time, got into a pretty low place because I felt kind of useless, which then re-brought up the guilt. And what I kind of just want to say to people in that is, if you do find yourself in that part of the process, it's a normal response for people who haven't been through infertility, let alone people who've been through infertility and then a whole bunch of shit and then used a donor and then have a whole bunch of anxiety to do with using a donor and additional guilt and etc. So it's actually just whatever you're feeling is valid and okay to feel, is essentially what I'm saying there.
Yeah. Wow. That's some, incredible advice there. One bit that really stood out to me was that kind of ebb and flow in a relationship when you're going through this over such a long period of time as well, that there'll be points where we, like you as a bloke, need the support, where, and other times where your partner does, and then like we step in. Yeah, really, really good advice there. And also, like you said, finding in the midst of all the shit, just that little bit of joy. And knowing that, yeah, of course, that's the infertility stuff isn't going away. You're still going to have to come back and address it. But those little nuggets, just to fill your cup a little bit, just to get you through it and remind yourselves of who you are as individuals and as a couple, is really important. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, those just little nuggets are really good in terms of just those little things to show that you do appreciate, you know, your partner being there. You know, they're tiny things. I used to do Flower Friday. So every Friday I'd buy a bunch of flowers. And we've continued it. I still do it. But it started because I felt like you did. I didn't know what to do. I felt horrendously guilty. And as a kid, I just remember my own dad coming home with a bunch of flowers when something had gone wrong. So I was like, I'll just crack on with that. Like, and it's gone on now. Like, and if I don't turn up on a Friday without a bunch of flowers, I get this eyebrow raised now and I look around. Like, but at that time, it was really important. And your advice there has been is amazing, mate. Really, really good. I feel like I always say it to everyone, but I could generally talk to you. we could just keep this conversation going, because your experience is a really valid and important one, mate. And I think so many guys are going to pick up important bits of information from this conversation. So as we end each podcast, we like to ask our guests one question. And the question is, if you could give one piece of advice to a guy who's going through infertility or facing infertility, what would that one piece of advice be?
Or Klinefelter's. Because there's that separate situation as well. So, however you feel you can best make use of that question for anyone who needs it.
So I would say that whether it's infertility, whether it's Klinefelter's, whether it's men or women who are listening to this podcast, I think it's about finding people who you feel comfortable enough to speak to about what you're going through. So being open with people that you feel comfortable with, whether that's friends, family, someone that you've found through your diagnosis, or a support group that you've found or such. We found that we had to kind of educate people along the way, friends, family, etc. And I think that changes the dynamic of a friendship or of a family relationship. And I think that you find that the people who are open to accepting that you have changed and your experiences have changed you are the people who are going to stick around and be kind of a friends and family for life. And the people who can't accept that you have gone through this thing which may have fundamentally changed you as a person, it's harder to retain a relationship with, and that's okay. So I think I haven't done very well at one thing, but to be open with the people that you feel comfortable with and seeking those people out, because talking about what you're going through is so, so important, would be my piece of advice.
That's great advice, buddy. Really good bit of advice. And something that's hard, you know, to do, but no, first conversation with those people that you want to be trusting is such an important thing. Great piece of advice, bud. So it's been a real pleasure to have you on, mate. It's been a great chat. As I said, we could talk all night, I feel. I'm sure we'll have you on again, or our paths will cross again at some point, and we can continue this conversation. But thanks Absolutely. For coming on.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you.
Been a real pleasure. And thank you on behalf of all the guys that are going to be listening to this, because you've shared some really valuable information and your story. So thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to be able to talk about it on such a meaningful platform.
Excuse me. It's a pleasure.
Mark, you mentioned that you shared your story, and you have been sharing it. Is there anywhere where guys can find you to read about what you went through, your thoughts and feelings at the time?
So my wife and I set up a anonymous Instagram account where we basically just put some thoughts around the different things we were going through, which we'll link in the show notes. And I never expected to actually have to say the name of it kind of out loud, but the handle is putting the X in sepsi, where the end bit is XXY.
Nice.
That's cool, man.
Excellent name. And yeah, you ain't anonymous anymore. Thank you for sharing everything, you know, your story, that account is, it means so much to so many. So really, thank you for coming on.
Speak soon. Bye. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at The Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.